Welcome to Human Lab, the science between us. This is Amy Elkon, science-based, nationally syndicated columnist and your host, interviewing the luminaries of behavioral science. My guest tonight is noted intelligence and creativity researcher Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, who will lay out the science on how you can be at your creative best. Scott has a new book out. It's great. It's co-authored with Carolyn Gregoire, and it's Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Now, it happens to have a big scribble on the cover. This is right on, because one of the things Scott observes, and not in a sneering way, is that creative people have messy minds and messy processes. I'm looking at my desk. This is definitely true. So reading that made me feel better, because my writing process for my books and my column basically involves making a huge mess. So wildly typing pages and pages of text to music and then going back through them to pluck out these little gems I see or things that could be turned into something, things that I maybe didn't notice or think about, think of them as of value when I slammed them onto the page. So there's part of that that's a pretty unconscious process, and it seems that this is helpful to our being at our most creative, one of the things anyway. Stick with us as Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman explains why that is, along with the many other best practices of creative people that you can make your own and be more creative or more effectively creative in your work, in your life. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Amy. How's it going?
Great. I love having you on. You're a very repeat guest. And so I want you to give us an explanation of what creativity is.
Oh, what a great question. And people have been trying to figure that out for a really long time. The way I like to view creativity is something that is original and meaningful. So it's something that we put into being in this world that has never existed before and makes some sort of sense to ourselves or to others.
I really like that definition. And actually, it reminds me of something I read. This is a researcher you work with, James C. Kaufman. No relationship.
Yeah.
He called...
He's my brother from another mother.
I like that. He and his co-authors called creativity effective novelty, and that really seems to describe what you're talking about.
Yeah, that works too. And it, you know, it doesn't have to be a world-changing, revolutionary history books kind of creativity. What we talk about a lot in the book is creativity as a way of being, a way of relating to the world.
Yeah, I really like that. And that's something you talked about, this guy, I forget his Japanese name, Miyamoto, who did Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
And I loved his philosophy you wrote about. You said that he says anything can be turned into fun and games. And I looked at my life and I realized I do this. Like, I mail my assistant her check, and I found out that checks were getting stolen. So I decided to write something on the envelope that made it seem like no one this bizarre would send money in the mail. And so I write her these funny messages. You know, I just pluck them out of the shoebox of my mind, but she actually finds them funny enough to post on Facebook. And that's one of those things, like, I mean, just why send a check? Why make it boring? You know, do something that's really, you know, a good time for you and the person who gets it.
Yeah, you're always, something I really like about you is you're always making new, you're always seeing possibilities where no one else is seeing them.
Thank you. And
yeah.
And so maybe that's one of the, you talk about the common strands across creative people and creative fields. So is that one of them, and what are some others?
Yep, that sure is one of them. And I think that goes along with openness to experience that we talk about in the book, being able to kind of find awe in the everyday experience and being open and receptive to beauty, to being curious, making time for solitude. Daydreaming is a really big one we talk about in the book. You mentioned imaginative play already with the Nintendo founder. Passion is one. Mindfulness is one. And you may notice, I'm not going to give them all away, though. I'm going to leave a couple for people to buy the book. But if you notice in some of the things I listed, Amy, you notice how some of them may seem like incompatible or kind of contradictory. And, you know, for instance, like mindfulness and daydreaming may seem incompatible. And that was a big point we wanted to make in the book, is that creative people are characterized by their messiness.
Right. And actually, you say, you use this term contradiction, you know, that people, you know, who are creative, there's a lot of contradiction there, but that you have to manage it.
Yeah, they're seeming contradictions. But what it really is that people, the creative people are really good at being adaptable. They're really good at they're really flexible at switching between these different modes of consciousness. And, you know, it's not like, you know, for most people, these things are segregated. And I think that is what separates really creative people from everyone else.
Yeah, I find that flexibility is really, really important because otherwise you'll just break. And just to give you an example from a conversation I've been having with another author, like me, like all nonfiction authors, she sold her book after writing an outline of what it's going to be. And so the hilarious thing that we've both found on our current books is that your book ends up telling you what it's going to be. You know, you don't tell it what it's going to be. And you describe Picasso's painting of Guernica similarly.
Oh, yeah. You kind of don't know where you're going until you get there. And that's what a lot of artists go into their work. And there's not like a set goal. There might be a hazy sort of goal, but they're very open. Like, again, open to new experience. They're open to trial and error, to putting things down and then completely erasing it. But yeah, the process of Guernica, scientists have looked at that trajectory, and there are lots of drafts that were totally omitted in the published version, but it seemed like, you know, there was like a couple steps forward and then a couple steps backward, a couple steps forward, so it's not like he was definitely doing that. It was not like he was necessarily doing this upward trajectory. There was this nonlinear process.
Yeah, I really find that where this thing I talk about with making a mess, that I have to write a bunch of stuff out, down. And there's this quote from Joan Didion that I love that she says, "I write to know what I think." And this is also true that I have to write a bunch of stuff down on the page and then I think about it and go back and forth. And this is a big part of this process of my writing that I never realized was what writers do, or it's what I do anyway, to find the gems within the mess on the page.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Is that how you describe your own process?
Well, no, I just described it that way. Now, I didn't really think about it, and I didn't really describe it to anyone. It just is my process of finding these things. And but, you know, there's something that goes along with that, and you sort of alluded to that, and it's failure. And you have to be okay with this making a mess and sucking and being stupid and not funny and not clear.
Oh, yeah.
And all these things on your way to getting to maybe someplace.
Oh, yeah. It's actually called the equal odds rule. You know, it's really creative people. The more that you produce, the greater chances you're eventually going to have a masterpiece. And that's actually regardless of quality. So when you do a complete analysis of the body of work of creative people, you see there are just like more clunkers than like anyone else in their generation. They just happen to have a few that were the best things of their generation.
Yeah, and Greg, Greg's my producer, who was Elmore Leonard's researcher for 33 years, he quotes Elmore on Skype. He says, Elmore says, "I make it up as I go along," you know, and that thing of just, you know, flying without a parachute really is pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it doesn't mean that there's no talent involved or no skill, but, you know, expertise is not the special sauce of creativity. You know, expertise is characterized by its consistency, whereas creativity is really characterized by that trial and error and variability.
Yeah, and you talk about this passion and practice, and there are a lot of misconceptions about what it takes to make it as a creative person, and you talk about them being intertwined, passion and practice.
That's true. Yeah, I think that they're a feed-off in the cycle. A lot of times we can dive into something that we may not necessarily be passionate about yet, but it grows. Passion can grow. Interest can grow over time. When we put more effort, we tend to find more meaning in what we're doing, and we tend to increase our skill set. And then our increased skill set then increases our passion. It's also a lot like relationships as well. You know, we may not be totally feeling the person, but, you know, love grows, right?
Well, I think you have to start from a base, and I think it's the same with creative practices, and you get into that too, you know, about talent and passion, and you talk about different kinds of passion, harmonious passion versus obsessive passion.
That's right. So harmonious passion is a form of passion that's like really well integrated into the core of your day. The activity that you're passionate about is well integrated into the core of your day. It's integrated in a really healthy way. So it's not based on contingencies like money or even self-esteem. And you enjoy the process of learning and discovering in this particular activity. And that can be contrasted from obsessive passion, which is a form of passion where everything's based on contingencies. You know, like if you don't do well, it's tied up to your whole self-esteem. Like, I'm a terrible person. But the similarity between both obsessive and harmonious is that both are part of your identity. So it's not like I like to play basketball, it's I am a basketball player. But the difference really is in how it's integrated into your identity.
So it seems like one is internal rewards. So harmonious passion is internal rewards, and obsessive passion is external rewards, like, oh, I want to be rich, or I want to get an Academy Award, not I love acting or writing plays or whatever it is.
Yeah, but it's slightly different than intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. Passion is one step above just motivation. You can have motivation for something, but it can be a very transitory thing, not really something that's part of your identity. But when it's something that you're really passionate about, it really is who you are, and it's like you and the activity are one.
Yeah, I really like that. It's like, tell people what flow is. It's like you are the flow state. So if you can explain what flow is and explain how you can be that.
I wouldn't mind being a flow state. That would be great. So flow is that is seemingly magical state of consciousness where you and the activity are one. Time, it feels that way because time recedes in the background. You are completely absorbed in the activity. All your attentional resources, and attention is a very limited spotlight, but all of your attentional resources are allocated to the task at hand. And flow can operate in lots of different domains. It operates in sex, right? It operates in good social interactions, and it operates in creativity.
Yeah, and actually, I think that there are best practices to get there because, you know, when you see the blank page is a horrifying thing for a writer. It's very scary, you know, and you can be okay with failing and everything, but you don't really look forward to, like, why don't I go fail now? Why don't I go, you know, suck on the page? And so one of the things that I do is I use a timer to write. And so I do 52 minutes on and 17 minutes off. And what happens is you just sit there and, like, okay, I have time to go. The timer's like my Stalin. And so I don't stop until that 52 minutes is over. And what happens is eventually you're like, oh, okay, stupid. And, like, okay, I'm going. But you get lost at some point, usually, and sometimes for a lot of time during that time. So I know that you talk about other ways that creative people work. Can you talk about some other people's practices?
Well, I just loved what you just said. You know, I don't want to go over that. We need to trust the process a lot more than we do. A lot of people with anxiety issues as well, they may feel like a panic attack is coming on or something, but if they just keep staying focused and mindful, eventually they lose their sense of self and they transcend it and their anxiety goes away. And I think it's analogous to the writing process. You know, there is that point where you're like, oh, I have writer's block, nothing's going to happen. And then you get to a point where you don't realize it, but you're actually engaging in it. And it's almost like falling asleep. You know, like there's a point in which we don't even remember it, but we fall asleep and we lose track of it. So I think that's just a really great point, that you have to trust the creative process.
And that is one of those contradictions that I love from your book, this idea that you have to lose your sense of self by being so much yourself that you stop thinking about it.
Yes, really.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love that.
It takes a certain kind of ego. It's a non-narcissistic ego. There's a healthy form of self-esteem that is very conducive to creativity, but then there's an unhealthy form of self-esteem, which is tied to that obsessive passion, that isn't.
Yeah, and it really is about the love of the thing, because as much as I say, like, oh, and I'm sucking and it's not funny and everything, when you come up with that thing that you think, wow, that's exciting, at that moment, then, I mean, it's just that's what makes me write, as opposed to doing something, you know, I don't know, being whatever it is people do where they have those big houses in Beverly Hills. So I guess some of them are writers, but mostly not of nonfiction books. So,
oh, my God. Aren't those the porn producers?
Right. Well, we went to someone's house, and I thought, what do you do to get this wealthy? They had a painting on the wall.
Yeah, but we never went to porn producers.
Right, we didn't when you were in L.A.
For the record.
So one thing that's really interesting about the practice of your particular thing is that you explain that it's possible to practice too much, that you get kind of rigid from too much practice.
Yes. Oh, wow. Thank you for reading my book.
I love your book. Cover to cover. I try not to talk over you, but I just did. So so too much practice. Tell us about that.
We're excited. We're both excited.
We are.
You know, there's this, like, 10,000-hour rule I'm sure you've heard of.
Yes.
That's not really a rule. It's actually an average. People take much, much longer to you know, there are a lot of late bloomers to become an expert in the field. Some people have just amazing talent, and it takes them like a year, or what it takes them 5 years, and they get there. But yeah, like I said, creativity is not characterized by that kind of linear efficiency. It really is characterized by that constant trial and error and playfulness and things like that. What was your specific question?
Oh, I know. Well, it's that actually, you know, that you were saying that it's possible to practice too much and get too rigid from
yeah.
it. You get and get sort of stiff, but you say that there's something that you call cross-training that can help you
yeah.
avoid this.
Yeah, cross-training is really important, where you go from field to field and you integrate all the knowledge you learn from different fields. And some of the greatest composers, like opera composers, Dean Simonton did this great study with opera composers and found that the most creative ones were those that composed in completely different genres within their field, which is called cross-training. But you do see that over and over again. It's not the creators who are narrowly focused and practiced in one field. And there does seem to be an optimal point upon which too much expertise can hurt. In fact, again, Dean Simonton has found that with creative writers, every year above second year in grad school for creative writing significantly decreases your chances that you'll actually write anything creative.
Wow. Yeah,
I never
felt compelled to go to school for writing. I just think you just write. That's what Elmore says too, Elmore Leonard, the crime writer, late crime writer, unfortunately. One of my favorite chapters in your book, and I should tell people, I am talking with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. His book, co-authored with Carolyn Gregoire, is Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. It's about the habits of a creative person, which you can have even if you maybe don't think you're such a creative person. So getting onto this chapter on intuition, I love that chapter. And Christopher Chabris, who's another researcher I've had on, does research on how wildly off our intuition can be. And intuition generally gets a bad name as a form of irrationality, but I love the way you talk about this. You say, basically, if you're using your intuition well as a creative person, there's a lot that goes into these supposedly magical judgments. They aren't magic. So tell us.
Yeah, I studied in my dissertation in grad school. I studied something called implicit learning, which is a certain kind of learning that you do without level of awareness. It kind of operates underneath the level of awareness. But there's nothing magical about this. You know, we have these really rich learning mechanisms that allow us to soak up the rule structure of the world and patterns and see patterns. And we don't really we're often not consciously aware of those patterns, but we feel it intuitively when we meet someone new who matches an old profile of something. Like if we see someone who looks exactly like an ex-girlfriend, we often are attracted to that person or not. It depends on how that turned out.
Right.
But intuition, we have these really powerful intuitive mechanisms. And I think that we'd be remiss not to listen to them at all, you know, when it comes to creating. But, you know, like Christopher talks about in, you know, his book, The Invisible Gorilla, the importance there is to know when to do which, when to rely on rationality, when to rely on intuition, and not let either completely dominate the picture. But nevertheless, I do think it's important to listen to your intuition, not completely let it dominate, but at least listen to it.
The thing I got from you, from your book, was really that you need to feed information in, and that when you have this information, that these sort of magical, supposedly magical judgments, they come out of something. It isn't just you pulled them from the sky. You pulled them out of all of this stuff that you have, that you've learned and picked up. And I think that that's really important. And this brings me actually to the two networks of the brain. Tell us about the two networks, because I use that in my productivity to be more productive.
Yeah. So there are a lot of large-scale brain networks that are constantly interacting with each other and communicating with each other to solve things. But two that seem to be particularly important for creativity is the executive attention network, or the focus network, and the default mode network, or the diffuse, or I also call it the imagination network. You know, these things have lots of names, but the real key distinction there is, are we really focusing and putting things in our working memory and trying to integrate information, plan, and organize, or are we imagining, we're kind of free-floating, daydreaming, mind-wandering, And even perspective taking is part of this imagination network, like imagining other people's perspectives. And creative people seem to be really good at switching back and forth between these two networks and kind of taking the fruits that they got in the imagination network and then allowing the executive attention network to focus and plan on it and then going back to the default mode or imagination network. So kind of toggling back and forth.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to give people the impression there are only two networks in the brain. There are many. Another one is salience. It's your motivation mode. But I just want to explain. So focus mode, that's when you're learning, you're reading something. It's really, this is this tight neural network. And diffuse thinking is a wider neural network. It's sort of, I think of it as background processing. So when you back off your work during my 17-minute break, when I go wash a dish or do something else, do something that's not focusing very tightly on the page, my brain basically, it's more efficient because it does this processing for me. I'm not thinking about it, but it does work for me. And this is why I learned, actually from Barbara Oakley, who I've had on the show, who I think you know a little bit.
I love her.
She's so great. Well, she talks a lot about this in her book, Learning How to Learn, and in her course on Coursera. And I forgot what I was going to say. It's a huge thing to do this backing off. Oh, I know what it is. Barb taught me to work. We talked about these networks, and I work every day on my column. I'll do like at least a little something, because what happens is overnight and during the day, my brain is working on this. It's noshing on it when I'm not even thinking about it. And so the next day I'll be much further ahead than if I just, put in the same amount of time on the same day. So it's really interesting how that works.
Yeah, it seems like you've mastered the creative process, or at least you're appreciating the importance of incubation.
Well, I try to put it on a leash rather than the other way around. But I want to ask you, because you've done a lot of work in the daydreaming area, and your mentor, I think Jerome Singer, I think I posted a link to a blog post that you guys did together. So
sure
tell
did.
Us about the importance of daydreaming and how you encourage it.
Yeah, there's different kinds of daydreaming that Jerome Singer, he's like the father of daydreaming research, published this brilliant book in the 60s. There are different kinds of daydreaming. One really important form of daydreaming is what he calls positive constructive daydreaming. And that's your ability to use daydreaming in a way that's really focused on helping you with your future goals, help resolve issues, help plan for the future, help simulate different things that could happen in your life so that you're more prepared when they do happen. Also, poets and writers use positive constructive daydreaming a lot to daydream about different worlds and different stories and plot lines. Another kind of daydream that's not as useful is the ruminative or dysphoric guilty, where you're kind of constantly just ruminating about things and feeling guilty about things. And that, we call that the neurotic imagination. And that doesn't seem to be as conducive to creativity as this positive constructive form of daydreaming.
And you say that we need solitude for inner reflection, that you can't just live this sort of multitasking life where you're constantly busy and constantly around other people.
Yeah, people are kind of overrated. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. But, like, for creativity, I think these kind of big board meetings, these kind of, like, these brainstorming sessions where you have, like, just, like, the extroverts are kind of just, like, talking the whole time, and it's not a true full of ideas, is not that conducive to creativity. There needs to be this back and forth between a more solitude form of the creative process, where people can get in touch with their deepest selves, make meaning out of their experiences, play around, do a lot of trial and error, and then kind of a collaborative form where they're sharing ideas, and they're getting feedback, and they're prototyping and testing it. This kind of back and forth between solitude and collaboration. But even with that said, I don't think solitude is really appreciated as much as it could in a business context.
Well, if you have an interesting mind, I have fun alone because I think about all these things. And if you can do that, I mean, that's something you can cultivate when you're taking a walk. Think about things. If you have to write a list of things to think about, I mean, it's just, you have to start somewhere. And we all have to get better at the things that we're not as good at, and takes practice. And I think that people are too unwilling to admit that they might need to practice something or work on something, and that they don't just have natural ability.
Yeah, people do want to take kind of the easy route to lots of things. I get the question a lot on the relationship between procrastination and creativity. I also get the question a lot on the relationship between drugs and creativity. I think people just want to take kind of an easy route.
Right. But I mean, I have read that Steve Jobs was very helped by taking LSD. And I mean, there is, I think, something to,
he also worked
fun.
A lot.
What?
Yeah. He also worked
right.
a lot.
Right.
So LSD does increase, it has been shown to increase your openness to experiences, which I said is really important for creativity. But there's more than creativity than just being open to new experiences. There are lots of these processes that we talk about in this book. And, you know, they all need to come together eventually at the end of the day. Creative people seem to be really good at harnessing these multiple traits. And, again, it keeps going back to the adaptability and flexibility aspect.
Yeah, and actually there's something very interesting that you talk about, sagacity. I don't know if that's your term, but you say that this is the term for the ability to find a worthy problem. And, I mean, that's a pretty
yeah.
essential starting point, or you really waste your time.
I think that was Einstein who said that.
Oh,
I don't want to take credit for Einstein. No.
Sorry, Mr. Ian.
I know, right? So problem finding is often the most important thing. In our school, you know, if we go back to education for a second, which I always talk about on your show every time I'm on.
What did you say? I missed that. It went by fast.
Oh, sorry, education. I always find a way to sneak in a point about education whenever I'm on your show. But we focus so much in education on problem solving. But we don't really give people the opportunity to flex their problem-finding muscles, and that's really important. Finding the right problem to solve in the first place is sometimes more important than your ability to solve an already existing problem.
And you talk about Elaine Aaron's research on the highly sensitive person.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that. It's very interesting. By the way, I checked off almost every one of those on the list in your book.
Yeah, I thought you would, actually. Me too. She's really done good work separating the highly sensitive personality from other personality dimensions. Like, it's not necessarily introversion, extroversion, because I think you're an extrovert who is highly sensitive. You know, you can be both. What it is in particular is how reactive you are to loud sounds. How much are you moved by the arts, by music? How much do you have a rich, complex inner life? Do you fantasize? So really is this heightened reactivity. And I think that's why people who are really creative, they fundamentally feel more alive.
You feel a lot, and it's really bad when someone's playing that low bass. If you're playing that in my zip code, I want to go find you and kill you. And other people don't seem that that reactive. And actually, but, you know, and this sounds like highly sensitive person. That just sounds terrible. It just sounds like neurotic jerk. But Bruce Ellis and W. Thomas Boyce, they proposed a hypothesis that this reactivity was favored by natural selection because it had benefits within many environments. I mean, you are, when you're this sensitive,
yeah.
you see more, you feel more. And so maybe you can foster the things you see into something useful more than somebody who's not really like poked and prodded by their environment as much.
Yeah, and that really is a common theme that runs through all of this, to kind of tie everything we're talking about together. Creative people are really sensitive, and they're aware. It's kind of an awareness. They're very mindful of human nature, of the larger patterns, and that allows them to create more meaning out of their experiences, and then share those meanings to the world to reveal universal truths. And those are the works of art. And science that really transcend the ages.
Unfortunately, this is our last comment and question because we're running out of time. But I love how you write that people, you know, they think that art has to be born of adversity. And you say it often is. But you say that creative work doesn't require adversity. And you quote this Harvard Med School psychologist, Marie Forgeard, I guess, saying that adverse events force us to re-examine our beliefs and our life projects in a way regular life doesn't. And so you say that people can do that, you know, you don't have to be miserable, that you can take that, you know, intense examination to your life without that unhappiness, without misery.
Yeah, long story short, you don't need to it just so happens, you don't need to be miserable in order to be creative. It just so happens a lot of creative people are miserable just because it's part of the human condition. It is part of the human condition, all of us. The Buddha said 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. What I think creative people are particularly good at is taking a lot of those experiences, those traumatic experiences that a lot of people go through, and channel it into their creativity, use it for their creative growth. Of course, trauma is not good, but those unusual experiences that kind of shatter your assumptions of how the world works can kind of give you this outsider's mindset that can be very conducive to creativity.
That is really great advice. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab, The Science Between Us. Scott, thank you so much. My guest tonight has been Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and his book, co-authored with Carolyn Gregoire, is Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Thanks again. Great show.
Thanks, Amy.
Guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Progressive presents Mindflowness with Flow.
You are a mighty fortress of supreme knowledge.